Good morning.
Good morning.
Probably everybody knows its topic is contrast and similarity, if there are any, between Marxism and Christianity. And right at the beginning, I would like to ask you and hear what is really your background and perspective on Marxism. How, you know, when you hear the word Marx, Karl Marx, or Marxism, what are the associations you make at that point? What do you think is that? What does it ring in your ears? I'd like to hear so we can maybe have a good start. Where we are. Yeah?
I associate it directly with communism.
The word dictatorship.
Dictatorship? Mm-hmm. Very good.
Non-Christian.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, maybe I should.
Dirty word.
Is it tough, double M communism? And dictatorship.
Any way you spell it, it's the same thing.
Good. More. What do you associate with this word? I mean, you've been living in a society which was pretty strongly and consequently opposing the Marxist ideology, and therefore I would like to know where you're standing, where is your position?
Socialism.
Pardon me?
Socialism.
Okay.
I guess my most recent ideas are personal through this Ethiopian family, whose children were being spoon-fed Marxism 3 hours a day within the school system, some of whose family had been killed by the government, controlled by them. But the idea that they were using Marxism to indoctrinate the young people there was one thing. And I can't say that I have a tremendous background on what it is, but what it did to their lives, what the people who espoused this did it in their lives, has had a tremendous impact on
me. Okay, I think that most of those terms, I would say probably all of them, do have something to do with Marx, though most of them, socialism, communism, non-Christian, ideological indoctrinations, those are byproduct. But I do believe that the seeds of those tendencies are, well, those practices or characterizations are embedded already in Marx himself and in his thought. I will give you a very short and brief overview of his life and background, also the philosophical background. It's extremely important to understand what Marx stand and which direction he went. So be a little bit patient, it will be just only a few sentences to carry through with me. And then we'll go into a few key concepts and contrast that with the Christian belief or Christian faith. Marx was born to the Jewish family, and his father, 6 years before Karl Marx was born, was baptized into the Lutheran Church. The reason for that was primarily because he was a lawyer, and at the time, after the French Revolution, the Europe went again, became quite conservative, and it was a new wave of anti-Semitism. So whatever the law and freedoms Jew had at the time, they lost. So he was, as Isaac Berlin says, he was before the decision to either practice the law or and become a Christian, and thus to deny his heritage and identity, or to go back into ghetto and live on the lowest part of the society. So he chooses the first one, Also very important is bear in mind that he is a child of enlightenment, a strong belief in progress, that somehow the end of the 18th century the whole culture and history is progressing towards freedom, equality, justice, and he firmly believed that though for a short time this might bring us. Oh, I'm sorry, thank you. That this persecution would not last forever. Marx had a very good background in education. He was well educated in particularly in art, in philosophy, and especially in literature. Later on, when he went to university, first Bonn for a short time, and then to Berlin, he studied law and philosophy. Thus, the law becomes for him a very important background for the future. When he starts studying economy, on the scene appears in Germany at that time, appears a very important philosopher, Hegel. And for Hegel, to make it very simple and quick, a major idea was to envision history, since the human being is not anymore a being of nature, but being a rational being is a being of history. Every human being has its own history and participate in a larger history. And this history is primarily a continual objectivization of the absolute spirit. It sounds very metaphysical, but what he was trying to say that at any given point there is always a form of equilibrium. In other words, that a culture with the given ideas, understanding, and self-consciousness comes to the social objectivization and the institutionalization. For him, the final and the most fine expression of this absolute spirit, though not identical, was the German state and the right of the German state. How the history progressed was that he discovered the law of dialectics. That in other words, to apply that to your situation, would be to say that you have era before Carter, you have a Nixon. And most of the society doubts in his sincerity, in his ability to be a sincere leader as a president. And you're looking as a society for someone who would fulfill these requirements, particularly after the trauma of Vietnam War. So it is kind of a continual balancing. One opposite balances another one and brings the synthesis. And that's the way the history progresses from the lower form to the higher form of existence. Marx, in Berlin University, Berlin was highly influenced by this thought and had a very strong influence on the politics and economy, and particularly on the understanding of the state. And thus, by 1841, they become the young students at the university and intellectuals around the university in Berlin. They become kind of the leftist Republicans opposing the kingship or royal office of the King of Prussia at the time. Is it trying to understand that the Republic will be the becoming or the new form of the order. However, on the scene appears another person and another philosopher, which Feuerbach, which criticized very strongly Hegel and says this absolute spirit is nothing else but a story. Actually, what it is a projection of the natural man. In other words, it is a man or human being with her or his own desires, needs for basic things like food and clothing, as well for love and supposedly more complicated form of life, it does not understand the social fabric or life of social life, starts projecting himself selfishly and creates religion. For Feuerbach, basically, it was a human being, a natural being, who is existing in the society, not an individual, but a social being who finds home in the society, once living in accordance with the society or societal needs. Also, the University of Berlin, there was in the Christian spectrum or theological spectrum or realm of the university, there's a growing criticism of the historical accuracy of the Bible. There is a fellow theologian Bauer who criticized that actually the New Testament as well, Old Testament is nothing else but a bunch of the story and mythology without any historical accuracy or historical background. This is another attack upon a very firm and strong institution of a society, church at that time. So Marx, growing from the Lutheran Church and having fairly pious approach to the religion, growing in a very optimistic atmosphere of the home, is moving towards more revolutionary field when it comes to Berlin, and becomes influenced by Hegel and later on by Feuerbach, which gives the beginning of his major thought. And indeed, already in 1844, he writes the book To the Critique of the Hegelian Philosophy of Right, which was basically what Hegel was trying to say, that there's this marvelous and ultimate objectivization of German Republic. He writes the very important, which everybody probably knows of you, that religion is opium of the people. So, in other words, he already at that point makes a pretty good observation. Church, obviously, let me make my observation. Church in the 18th century, beginning of the 18th century as well, beginning of the 19th century, becomes a supporter of status quo. The church is indeed, particularly in Germany, is absolutely an institution in the hands of King of Prussia. It is nothing else but to reinforce an official state ideology and to support the, I would say, civil religion of the king. And Marx observes that very well and says that the Christianity, though he had a tremendous love for Jesus, he was very impressed with his love for children, for people. Nonetheless, he sees this discrepancy, and unfortunately, he makes the criticism, as we do very often, not being able to distinguish between the church as an institutionalized form and the church as a messianic phenomena. And what he criticized, in my opinion, at that point, is criticizing the church as a social manifestation, the promise which comes into the broken world and doesn't exist never perfectly. Nonetheless, at that time, I think that the church was indeed in a tremendous trouble. I mean, it has been totally assimilated by the culture, and church was unable to make any statement independent from the state. He travels to Paris, he meets Engels over there, and they become friends for life, both ideologically of similar persuasion, but on top of it, Engels becomes his financial support in the years of 50s and 60s when Marx lives in England in absolute, the lowest form of existence. Simply, they lived in six children living in two rooms. They didn't have enough food to buy bread sometimes. The children have to learn to lie to the people who are coming for money, to debtors, to say that Mr. Marx ain't at home. He had to even escape London one time. He lived on Soho, one of the poorest sections of London. But in the meantime, he travels to Paris. He's expelled from Paris. He goes to Belgium. He returns from Belgium to Germany for a while, and then he goes to England again. It is a very, very decisive period. And the first part of the 19th century in Europe is extremely important because France, one of the strongest power, political and cultural center, is going through the continual turmoil of revolution, starting with the French Revolution, having the Napoleon re-establishment of Bourbon, royal house, and in 1848 starts so-called the Spring of People, which is basically involves the revolution sweeps through entire Europe. It includes Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Germany, and Marx is very hesitant. He doesn't know how to react very clearly to the political situation at that point. On one hand, he's a strong sympathizer with all the trade unions, both in England and France and Germany. Yet at the same time, he believes that the changes in the social and political and historical, by and large, dimension comes naturally. He was hesitant to support very, very extreme wing of the radicals in England and Germany to push for the revolution. Yet when he experienced in a short period of organizing revolution movement in Germany and saw that collaboration with the so-called bourgeois, well, middle class, that time coming to the power spectrum of society, he saw that it will never work, that those people who are trying to establish their own small businesses will never after all liberate the workers. So he goes back and forth. He's the revolution in France, in Camus, in 1870, it was the purest and most classical workers' revolution. First he withholds his opinion, is against, then he praises them. He also has an encounter with Bakunin, who was a Russian rebel anarchist. He despised him very strongly. He didn't trust any Russians, but he was a very strange person. And he didn't like disorder. As a good German, he thought that this whole process will go step by step. In other words, first becomes a middle class or bourgeois revolution, which liberates the society from the feudal system, overlordship and peasants. And then when the contradiction between the labor and the ownerships of the means of production, in other words, of those who own the factories and trade and so forth, will come to the highest point of conflict, then they naturally come to the point of changes, and they finally will come to the position of establishing the dictatorship of workers. He thought even at some point, very naively, I'm sure that Lenin didn't like that, somehow at a certain point of this tension, the middle class will understand that its role in a history ends, and the workers will take over as a final liberation. Later on, he in England, he spent the rest of his life in England after 1845, I believe. He studied a lot of at the British Museum, and studied a lot of studied history and studied in the perspective of economy. He was probably for the first time one who studied the economy, politics, in a very dynamic perspective, in interrelating all the disciplines, trying to get a very large picture of the social development. In order to make the contrast between the Christianity and the Marxism, I think for us the most basic interest would be in the Marx anthropology, in other words, science of men or humans, who humans are. Definitely he rejects the idea that the God is responsible for I mean, in his picture, there is no place for God. Starting point is a point of man, humans in nature. Forgive me this uninclusive language. In Polish, there is a language, there is a word for for man and woman, like in German, der Mensch. So, at any rate, his starting point is nature, and human is a part of the nature. Is like the rest of the animal world, and nonetheless, his needs of food, of clothing, of being loved, of all higher needs, are somehow outside of him, and he has to reach, struggle for them, for the food, for the clothing, for the stable society. And in this process, he becomes master of the nature. He liberates himself or differentiates himself or herself from the nature, in opposition to nature, and becomes free, yet at the same time understanding nature and mastering the nature. So already at that point, I would like to stop and make the comparison with the picture of the human and the world, which we have in most clearly in Genesis, or most readily available, the story about creation in a Genesis. There is a very important and unclear statement that the people were created in the image and likeness of God. We try to explain that in all kinds of various way, saying, we are kind of similar to God because we have reason, will, memory. There is several kinds of combination in a kind of a Trinitarian concept, trying to reflect the Trinitarian nature of God and saying that this likeness of man, of God in man or humans, has also this Trinitarian concept of that we are rational, that we are that we have memory. But recently, I think we're coming to the conclusion that that's not the point. The likeness or image which has been bestowed on us in creation is nothing else but to have dominion or stewardship over the creation. In other words, through us, God communicates as those who are conscious of God, a link between the creator and the creation. So the picture is a little bit different. In the Jewish thought or Christian thought, we are, upon us is bestowed the privilege and at the same time responsibility to be a wise and a responsible stewards in the world, and at the same time be part of the nature and yet be this part of the nature which governs and helps and takes care. Marx introduced the idea of struggle. Indeed, humans are part of the nature, but in order to become, to differentiate themselves, they are, simply saying that they are not animals or they are not tree, and they've got a different needs, and they organize themselves differently, and they are self-conscious. This comes about through human endeavor, through the struggle, through the opposition to the nature, and becoming becoming aware of themselves. Also, in his human or anthropological reflection, he came to the conclusion that the people, once establishing themselves or going through the process of differentiation, they can become free and independent, self-conscious, free of mastering the basic forces of nature. Yet at the same time, they can become again slaves, because acquiring or searching for the needs or supply of the needs, like food and clothing, they can estrange themselves from one another and from the society. And most rapidly comes to the picture in the 19th century in the capitalistic system, where the means of providing for the society, food and clothing and so forth, becomes also the matter of the object of the market. The people are called to work, or they have to work. They are not working for themselves, they are working the products. They're making the objects. They are not, farmer is not going to the field and plowing the field and raising food for his family, and whatever is left is exchanging in the market in the small town in the feudal Europe for some other objects. But he's working in the factory now. He's taken away from the farm. He's working, or she's working in the factory, producing or contributing in a small aspect, only producing one larger object and receiving money. Since again there comes the so-called surplus or interest, I mean the part of the income which comes to the pocket of the owner, people are being estranged. They are selling themselves. They are not paid properly, but foremost they are not receiving what they are working for. They have to exchange that, and by and obviously workers at that time lived on a very, very low level. I mean, there is, you know, the ghetto of New York or any place in the United States or in Europe is nothing in comparison to the condition of working in Europe at that time. I mean, there were children working, there were workers were working between 14 to 18 hours. That means they were basically sleeping if they were not working properly. So in order, but in human nature there is an innate desire or need to become free, to become in accord what they are. In other words, the worker wants to be free. He wants the dignity for his work, what he's doing. Because in this doing, he becomes what he is. And if he's cheated, if he's abused, and if he's used to make an enormous amount of money for it and bring enormous profit, he certainly is unhappy. He certainly is unhappy. So I think at that point, Marx and the most scholars would agree today that Marx was absolutely perceptive in terms of social observation, in terms of injustice, in terms of alienation of people and breaking the social structure, because everything became basically an object for production and an object for sale and object for market. And the people were estranged from that what they were doing, and what was sold became the object, representation, actual representation of their needs on the market. Overcoming of this estrangement, Marx saw through the process of a class struggle, the owners are becoming more and more greedy, and finally to the point that the system is kind of like a self-combustion. Those who want too much, they finally kill themselves by the very fact that, they kill the workers. In some sense, Marx was not very clear. I have to admit that it's either through the revolution, through the fact that the workers come to the understanding that it's too much, that they cannot stand anymore the oppression, they want to do, they will reach for the freedom, but also in the economical sense that the system somehow would go through the crisis and would not work. And anyway, he was not very clear on this major issue. That was later on developed by Lenin.
Were the farmers at the time better off than serfs of later times?
Farmers at the time were in the socialistic movement. The farmers were pretty much collaborating with the owners of the small capital.
So it was later that they were subjugated.
Yeah. Well, no, they were always subjugated, but the, you know, the feudal system, and the feudal system collapses in Europe pretty early, and they become like free farmers. And it varies similar. It varies from the you know, place to place. In England, it's basically huge families which own still, you know. So in Germany, there's a lot of small farming, even up till now. So it varies. But there was in Germany, for example, the farmers were collaborating with it, were working together with the owners of small shops and, you know, small factories and so forth.
They were kind of being enriched by the Industrial Revolution, weren't they?
Yeah.
And because there's more land available, they could cobble up, they could keep their own.
In the Christian perspective, this whole issue of estrangement and become to one's position of harmony, of what one ought to be or one desires to be or what one supposed to become. Actually, Marx is talking about in language of becoming. Man, humans become from the nature by the whole network of relationships, economy, politics, and so forth. They're becoming more and more estranged or removed from the nature and mastering the nature, as I said, and then to the point of by requiring and having the needs of food and clothes, this food and clothes becomes an object of manipulation of market, and thus a second subjugation of the part of the society. To remove that, Marx envisions, you know, class struggle. Some places he speaks about a revolution. Most likely, he thinks that it's a matter of system and a progress. In a Christianity, on the other hand, it's a you can real known word sin is the basis of estrangement. Now I think I would like to challenge you to look at the sin, because we understand sin and function for a long, long time for us Christians as a primarily a guilt, something which is not correct between me and God. However, in the Old Testament, sin was always had always a social manifestation. Obviously, it was a breaking the relationship with God, but it was always a breaking relationship within the covenant. So in other words, the sin against the neighbor was a sin against God. Or actually, every sin against God was a sin against the neighbor and had the consequences, social consequences. And the Christians lost that, and they're thinking that the only thing about sin is that what happens in my heart, that I sin against God in my heart. And that doesn't have any extension into politics, into economy, into culture. And I think, again, Marx, though coming from a completely different perspective, thinking about self-improving culture or self-improving system, process of history, coming to the final realization, kind of eschatological almost, final freedom in a communistic society, help us to realize Christians that the sin and estrangement has indeed a social manifestation and has a social repercussion, very concrete. Israel, you know, Israel sinning against oppressing rich people, oppressing poor people in Israel, finally understood and interpret that as the sin against God. So, in that respect, Marx is again for us helpful to see that the human being is both. We could not fully agree with Marx that the human being is absolutely a product of the economical relationships. In other words, the person can think, feel, and function only insofar as his needs are supplied. In other words, if the person is on the level of having glass of milk and a piece of bread and lives in a small house, his world is limited to what is his or her economical situation. Once those basic needs are being supplied, he may go further beyond that. That's indeed, in some sense, it is a one picture of what we are. As an economical creature, as a social creature, determined by the environment in which we live. But what Marx was coming short is definitely in understanding the human nature beyond that, and talking about sin and origin of man or humankind from God. I mean, he caught all this. He had only this, I mean, horizontal direction. Man somehow was human was somehow fighting against the background of nature, trying to differentiate and coming to some, maybe later on, higher form of freedom. He was nothing. He or she is the autonomous and ultimate source of life, source of understanding. In Christianity, I think Lutherans and Protestants came to that there is nothing, it's here's a vacuum. We kind of perceive that, you know, there is nothing around here, and they are individuals living somehow surrounded by their own guilt, fear, or joy, and here's a God connected immediately with him, without almost no connection in between, unless they are very moralistic, you know, be good and nice to each other. I think this picture, if we can bring this picture, understand that we are also social and political and historical, helps us to understand, and to understand also who God is, God of history. God is not a God, like a big cloud of power and wisdom hanging above our horizon of our lives. But the God is God of history, is moving us, taking us from the covenant relationship and leading us into the relationship with Christ. And foremost, it is God who enters the history. And this is probably the most dramatic thing which neither Hegel or Marx was able to understand, that the God dying on the cross, the Son dying on the cross, Son suffering the rejection and forsakenness by the Father, at the same time Father suffers the death. It's not the Son which suffers the death. Son dies, but that's God in his life suffers the death of the Son. And thus, in the most radical sense, the history, this internal history of the struggle, of injustice, of death and alienation, which becomes so important for Marx, becomes part of God. In God, human history finds rest. God knows human condition, not only by observing, but of experiencing firsthand. And knowing that, we cannot become anymore this. We cannot think of ourselves as the people who have individual connection with God, as the units who have a good feeling about or bad feeling about God. But we are the members of the nature or society moving towards goal in God. Because the human history became God's history. And this is probably further more radical than Marx himself was able to perceive. Nonetheless, indeed, he fought against Christianity of that picture. It was a Christianity which was trying to pacify and deny the human suffering and alienation. It was the Christianity which was telling people, don't worry, if you don't get your own due in this life, you'll get 10 times in heaven. And I think at that point Marx was closer to the understanding of the gospel, though denying God, that than the church itself at the time. Because in death of Christ, the justice and righteousness approaches us now. Not here, there in the future, up on the clouds, but now and here. By the very fact that all our suffering and all our alienation, all our wickedness and whatever form of our existence is incorporated in God. And that's a task, I think, the most radical task for the church today, to start realizing that our history is not somehow separated to the history of God. We're not living here on the bottom, and here's this big God who is helping you on ice, and we are wrong, he's sending a war. Quite all right, we make mess ourselves. But in this mess, he is with us. Because he himself, or God self, died in the person of Jesus Christ. Whenever it's time, I'm sorry I made a speech. If any reaction or question or whatever, I would welcome very much. So I'm sure it's very hard to come up with an idea right now to one person speaks over.
So to put it simply, Marx just in a way fell short of the whole picture because he only thought and moved so far.
You know exactly. I mean, he was operating with the concept which is very unbiblical. He was rebelling. You know, one could speculate. It's in the realm of speculation. One could speculate that the 19th century theologians and philosophers and leaders rebelled against this God, kind of monotheistic. Pardon me?
You agree.
I'm kidding.
And our rights are high.
Oh, thank you. This kind of this monotheistic or theistic God, authoritative God, God of you know power, God of right, God of wisdom, but always God above the humanity. And I think that the 19th century did indeed rebel against that. Bloch, the person who is even furthermore on the edge between Christianity and Marxism, German philosopher living for life in West Germany, makes a difference between the God of the Old Testament, which is God, indeed a Trinitarian God, or God of compassion, God who lives together with the humanity, and the God which we create is the authority to oppress and to make mess in the world. And Marx was indeed opposing and rebelling against this authoritative God of power, God of order, and not much God of compassion, God who suffered, God who died, God who was willing to include in God's own existence humanity and experience what humanity is. So in that sense, he came, you know, he did not understood, but neither the church at the time. That time was clear about the issue too.
He must have missed it that actually Jesus is the only manifestation of God that we can understand at all. In other words, Jesus said, "You see God, you see my Father in me."
Mm-hmm.
So he must have kind of missed, because Jesus was not like that, and Jesus had this. Social concern. I mean, that was his whole life, to be concerned about people around him. He must have kind of missed that picture of God, which was given to us so that we could see God.
He wasn't really seeing it demonstrated in Germany or wherever it was. That's that's probably why I missed it. Because all he had was the civil church.
But in Jesus himself, he should have been able to see it.
He didn't see God personalized at all.
Really?
No,
he missed
the whole picture, but then like Peter said, he did have the whole picture, in a way.
He had the whole picture of the, what the church was, but well, you know, it's real hard to say that the church did not know Christ at all. But by and large, church was not presenting a full picture. You know, that to know Christ, we can know Christ only as a believing community. I mean, there is no knowing Christ personally outside of community confessing Christ. I mean, there is no, you know, kind of nature.
But so that's scriptural too, that we being imperfect are not able to be. Even though we know, maybe even intellectually, this is the way we should be, we miss the targets so much on that. And even the apostles, they had their, you know, they stumbled around a lot too. But there was no assurance that we would be a perfect reflection of what Christ is or wants us to be. I think it's pointed out so often that we will simply stumble and bumble around. That you have to keep Jesus right in the center all the time. And I think he kind of got his eye off Jesus.
And bringing God down, the transcendent God, that and bringing him down, then this has evolved, would you say, even to this day in communism today, that then man becomes the God.
In other words, it was a rebellion against this authoritative God, and who was presented that way through the very authoritative type of the church. So, you know, it's not, I'm not talking about the nature of God. I'm talking about what was the perception, or what was the image of the God the church most readily and often upheld it, and it was the God who was not a loving God, and was not a God who was part of the human history, but was God authority and the social order and so forth.
I think that's what we have to do now too, is just kind of skip over what the church is going and go back into the scriptures, which delineates very clearly the nurturing, mothering qualities of God. And I'm not into sexist language or any of that stuff, but I mean that he does have such mothering, nurturing qualities, and there's so many images. I'd like to gather you under my wings like a hen, all these kinds of things. And Abba, Father, which kind of means daddy, you know, the kind of person that you can go to with everything. So I guess it's saying you better get back into the Word of God itself if the church is not, you know, the church is not going to measure up ever. And so then you just go right back into the Word.
Can I ask a question that diverges a little? You kind of were heading toward suggesting a synthesis between what the church was doing at the time with its you know, close relationship between God and man, and Marx's ideas of healthy relationships between man and man. Do you think that has been done at all in the church now? You know, where they have both those things working at once to some degree?
Well, being unhealthy optimist.
Say that again.
Being unhealthy optimist.
Okay.
I think that there, you know, I mean, we have only hope. There is indeed at the present time the movement of rediscovering the Trinity, but not in the form of kind of a speculative language trying to describe who God is in God's self, but trying to understand that the Trinitarian God is God of relationship. And thus, I would say there is a good possibility that the church will return to the image of the relational God, not authoritative God, but the relational God. And that will provide, gives us the basis for speaking up on the social issues and you know, to go outside of our individualistic understanding of Christianity and starting to see that there is a place. So the problem is that the place of the church is continually has been shrinking. Basically because we figure out that, you know, we need God to explain certain phenomena still. And that's the issue Barbara speaks, that unless we again put God in the middle, in the center, we'll be lost. And that's, you know, that's the position of the church, to bring the God. But how? It's indeed to understand appropriately who we are and understand who God is for us. To say it in other words, it is very important on what image do we operate. I mean, what is the operational image of God? Because that also reflects how we understand ourselves. I mean, our knowledge of ourselves and understanding is understanding, you know, we're always saying, well, I know only so far as I know that through Jesus Christ. But, you know, we have to over and over open those basic biblical images or truths for us. I mean, what does it mean that I know myself only insofar as I know in Jesus Christ? Well, it means it is suffering, it means it is being compassionate, being with the poor, and so forth. Being for others, that I'm not myself for my own sake with God, but I am, you know, I'm saved only because the world has been saved. I'm not saved because Jesus saved me. I'm saved because Jesus reconciled the entire world to God. And that brings entirely different perspective. I mean, it brings a tremendous picture of upholding entire world in the hands of God and claiming that as a position for the church. I think that the church needs to enlarge the perspective and the possibility of existence, first of all, for the future. And I think we are suffocating today because we are unable to project ourselves to the future. Our future is a bomb. And in whatever form it is it as our savior or is it as our threat? It is our limitation. And we cannot go beyond that. Yeah, but there's another lecture on the Trinitarian God. sorry.
Question.
Yeah.
Personally, when I always have to resist it myself, to resist, you know, reading Marx and find out where he's wrong. Because if I do that, I miss mostly what Marx is saying about my own Christianity and where it probably is wrong. And I'm wondering if you kept saying 19th century, the church was this way, this way, this way, this way. Mm-hmm. But part of me hears you saying, I'm not sure if you're saying it or not, and I'd like a more direct answer.
Yeah.
Is Marx good corrective for today? Is our church still too much this way? Or is it...
Okay.
I don't see the church ever. It's very seldom either or, one way or the other.
Yeah.
I see it internally struggling and internally contradictory, as well as not only internally in my own human person biography, but internally within the church as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering, can we learn from Christian Marxists, Christian Third World ones, Catholic ones,
mm-hmm.
African ones?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the Africans... but anyway... I think, you know, there has been a long tradition indeed, basically brought by Bloch, you know, the whole idea of that the only true Christian, how is it?
Atheist for God's sake.
The only true Christian is the one who is the atheist and a true communist or atheist who believes in God. So, in a sense, we can learn. Nonetheless, Marxism cannot provide the ultimate criticism. Marxism can point to the sort of dimension and aspects of the human existence. It's not individualistic, you know, like we are being taught constantly, you know, that it's my needs, me, but it's a society, it's a living for others. In this respect, we can learn, but then the whole idea of whose we are, I mean, where we're coming from, that we are children of God, and you know, this whole jazz is impossible to learn from the Marxists, and I'm very skeptical about it. Nonetheless, I think that the Marxists are telling us that the church suffered for too long under the authoritative God. I mean, the Reformed tradition, what they were talking constantly about the sovereignty of God, about, you know, the ruler of the universe, without seeing this God coming to earth, being born as a child and dying on the cross with the rebels or thieves. So in a sense, yeah, we can always learn, but I think that the Marxists cannot bring ultimately the you know, neither eschatological perspective nor transcendental, you know, that we are being created by God, that the society is a gift, because primarily it is the body of Christ. And any form of the social organization, it is on the image or on the basis of the given reality that we are body.
For me, I don't know why we go to all this baloney. Because Christ has made me, and he's given me free choice. And so I have to accept some responsibility. And if I don't accept that responsibility, and if I choose to go out here and be a Marxist, that's my problem. But if I want to follow Christ, then I follow Christ. And that's all there's to it. You know, it's simple.
It's not as simple because the Christian Church supported Hitler. Christian Church didn't spoke anything about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Christian Church has been silent for a very long time about poor and oppressed.
But you and I are the Christian Church.
But this is not as simple because it is not precisely. It is not your relationship between you and Jesus. You find the relationship between you and Jesus as you relate to one another. Galatians, Paul speaks very clearly. There was an issue for the Galatians. They were lost because he was bombarding them constantly. There is no law. No more law. You are living in a free. You are living in the Spirit. And they were constantly saying, you know, what the rules are. And you know what he said to them? Become slave of one another. Become slave of one another in love.
Okay, but that's the Christian way.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying where we do have that. I mean, where we do have that we become slave of one another. If we're living in a society when we continually, and I'm not saying that the state is state, but I'm just saying as a church, how do we open the gates to the poor and oppressed? I mean, how many churches are willing to say, if part of the body of Christ in Africa is suffering, I'm not willing to put soft upholstery in my church and I'm using this money to send to the Africa. Or I'm not willing to buy 10,000 lilies for Easter time and I'm sending this money to the people who are needed that. And so this is a problem that we are so narrow-minded about business of me and God and Jesus without losing the perspective, you know, who we are indeed as in relationship to God in the community. I mean, when and how often the church really claimed the responsibility of Jesus saying that if any part of the body suffers, the entire body suffers. We send missionaries to Africa not to teach them about Jesus, but to make them Christians of the European origin. We have to become a little bit more self-critical about ourselves.
The theory of Marxism and the practice of Marxism are...
Next topic.
Just ask the Ethiopians, they're pulled apart.